Hello, this is Mike Swanson. I'm the author of the book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In a few moments, another episode of The Great Parallax Views will begin. But before it starts, let me tell you about my book. It's available at Amazon.com, The War State. It's about how the United States became a global superpower after World War II and has brought us to this situation. Grab the book at Amazon.com after the show.
I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
In about 1992 and 1993, the CIA decided that they were going to open up a liaison office in Hollywood, because they had essentially gotten sick and tired of seeing these movies like 3 Days of the Condor, which depicted the CIA as a rogue agency.
Hey, Parallax News listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be discussing Hollywood, the CIA, and whether Tinseltown is really as progressive and liberal as people say, with Jim DiEugenio of the Kennedys and King website and author of The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today. He's also working on a documentary with Oliver Stone entitled Destiny Betrayed, which will be based on another book he's written by the same name. Now, you may be wondering, are we going to be talking about JFK? Well, you know, I wasn't as interested in talking about the Kennedy assassination, to be honest. You know, I don't even have a really strong take on it. I feel as if I come from a generation that is pretty far removed from the Kennedy assassination. There's not that same emotional connection that, you know, people who were alive during it, maybe in kindergarten or first grade or something like that, have to it. You know, those people can tell you where they were when the news first broke. So, I myself don't really have a strong emotional connection to the Kennedy assassination, but I've always found Jim to be rather interesting when I've come across his articles in places like Consortium News or on radio shows like Len Osanek's Black Op Radio. Beyond just covering the Kennedy assassination, he gives a lot of details on the history of foreign policy and Kennedy's foreign policy during the Cold War, which I think is very invaluable. It's fascinating history, even if you're not interested in the JFK assassination itself. And he's also something of a film critic. He's written multiple movie reviews for websites like the aforementioned Consortium News. And in his latest book, The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today, he deals extensively with the subject of Hollywood, the Pentagon, and the CIA, and the overlap between them. In other words, the influence that the CIA and the Pentagon have exerted over the entertainment industry. Now, this is an issue that is actually not really up for debate. It's pretty much an open secret. So, since Jim is most known for going on various radio programs and podcasts to talk about the Kennedy assassination, I thought, why not mix it up? He seems to have a great deal to offer on this subject of CIA and Pentagon influence on film and television. In particular, we discuss the movies Charlie Wilson's War and The Post, both of which purport to be based on true stories, but that Jim argues actually end up being very revisionist in their approach. And by the way, those two films involved the participation of Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg, who you'll hear us talk about throughout the conversation. And really, when we get down to the brass tacks of it, the question we end up asking beyond the CIA and Pentagon involvement in various Hollywood projects is this: is Hollywood really as progressive as people think it is? Is it really the bastion of liberal propaganda that the right-wing noise machine media would have us believe? Well, Jim DiEugenio argues it isn't. In fact, he says movies like Charlie Wilson's War and The Post reinforce rather than challenge the status quo. So hopefully this introduction has you a little bit intrigued. And with that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Jim DiEugenio of the Kennedys and King website, author of The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today, and the writer behind the upcoming Oliver Stone documentary series, Destiny Betrayed, based on Jim's book of the same name. Welcome to Parallax Views. Jim DiEugenio, the proprietor of the Kennedys and King website and the author of such books as The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today, and the upcoming Oliver Stone documentary series, JFK Destiny Betrayed. How are you doing, Jim?
Fine, Mike. Is that okay, Mike?
Yes, I can hear you perfectly, man.
All right.
So, Jim, I wanted to have you on because this book, JFK, The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today, deals in part with an issue I'm very interested in beyond the Kennedy assassination, and that's the CIA influence on the movie industry. But before we get into that, maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about the work you've been doing with Probe Magazine and the Kennedy assassination.
I began this way back in about 1991, when I was working on my first, the first edition of Destiny Betrayed, which was my first book. All right. And then once that was published, we began, there was a small group of us in LA who began a journal called Probe. That I took over in about 1995 with my partner, Lisa Peace. Okay. I was the publisher and editor. She was a co-editor. We did that about the year 2000. So there are 7 volumes of that, which you can actually order the CD on through JFK Lancer. And we broadened out into RFK and Martin Luther King also. All right. Now, in the new millennium, we began, myself and John Kellen, the author of Praise from a Future Generation, we began a website called CTKA, Citizens for Truth About the Kennedy Assassination. That went on for several years, longer than Probe. And then a new friend of mine, Al Rossi, took over as webmaster. He remodeled the whole website And today it's called KennedysandKing.com. All right. And we carry all kinds of stories on the JFK, the Malcolm X, RFK, and the Martin Luther King case. So if you add it all up, I've been doing this for about 25 years. Now, as far as the book goes, I'm the author of Destiny Betrayed, which, as you noted, is going to be made into a, well, it's already been made into a document, a four-part documentary series by Oliver Stone called JFK Destiny Betrayed. I'm the co-editor of a book called The Assassinations, which is kind of like an anthology of the Best of the Probe articles. And then my last book, as you just mentioned also, was The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today. That book has that title because I tried to put everything in it that had been declassified of pertinent value to the JFK case. But since it was a response to Vincent Bugliosi and Tom Hanks, because Tom Hanks and his partner Gary Goetzman had bought Vincent Bugliosi's book, Reclaiming History, and they were planning on adapting it into a documentary series, there is, as you mentioned, a rather long section of the book, I'd say at least three chapters, that deal with Hanks, Spielberg, and the connections of the CIA and the Pentagon into the modern Hollywood scene, which surprisingly, because to me it's a very important subject, okay? Surprisingly, very, very few writers have written about it. To my knowledge, there's only three books, and I guess we should mention them. There's only three books on this subject that I could find. One is called Operation Hollywood by David Robb. That deals with the Pentagon aspect. Okay. There's another book on the CIA called The CIA in Hollywood by Trisha Jenkins. All right. And the last one, which I happen to have with me right here, this is called National Security Cinema by Matt Alford and Tom Secker.
I've had Matt on the show. It's a very good book.
Oh, you have? Okay, yes. All right. I just communicated with Matt because Oliver read his book and he wanted me to reply to some of the things in the book. All right. See, now, the best way to look at those three books is that the Jenkins book is about the CIA, the Raw book is about the Pentagon, and this latest book by Alford and Tom Secker is a kind of combination, but it's updated because they did some more recent work through a Freedom of Information Act, and they got more updated information to lay upon the top of that. Okay, so I guess a good way to begin is that Trisha Jenkins' book discovered that after Oliver Stone's JFK came out in about 1992 and 1993, the CIA decided that they were going to open up a liaison office in Hollywood because they had essentially gotten sick and tired of seeing these movies like 3 Days of the Condor, okay, which depicted the CIA as a rogue agency that was going around the world and killing people, okay, and pulling off assassination plots. All right. And so they assigned a guy named Chase Brandon to run that particular office. All right. Brandon had been working on the clandestine side of the Central Intelligence Agency for over 20 years when he opened up this office. And I go in my book, I go through some of this stuff that he accomplished. And in summary, I was forced to conclude that whatever you think of this and whatever you think of Chase Brandon, he was incredibly successful in turning around the whole image of Hollywood with this latest generation of filmmakers. And I go through a couple of his successes, like The Sum of All Fears. All right. And, you know, he was so successful that when he left, the office only stayed open for 3 more years because, as his successor told Trisha Jenkins, it became self-sustaining. We didn't need an office anymore because we had these guys coming to us, you know, and they wanted to work with us. They let us see their scripts and make suggestions and everything. But in fact, as I later found out, Chase Brand did more than just make suggestions of scripts. From what an interview I did with someone, which he has to remain nameless, okay, he took over the writing of a lot of these screenplays. And he actually wrote whole scenes and sequences, okay, in them, all right? See, so this is a part of the story that I think really, really needs to be told, and I'm glad you're doing this. As far as Operation Hollywood goes, what the Pentagon does, and again, a lot of people don't know this, is that if you want to make a big military movie, all right, it's very expensive to either rent these planes or ships, et cetera, or to borrow them from another country. Okay. So the cheapest way to do it is to just go to the Pentagon and ask them if you can borrow these things, you know? Well, here's what the deal was with Phil Strub. Okay. He says, look, I'll let you do this, but we want to look at the script before we do it. And of course, anything that Phil Strub thought would be offensive, or let's say not as adulatory as he thought it would be, he would then send the script back and say, make these changes. The implicit threat being, if you don't make the changes, we're not going to give you the stuff. Okay. And that not only amounted to the Pentagon censoring freedom of expression, because in its darkest terms, that's what it amounts to. But if he would say no to a project, he could cancel the entire project because the production office was not going to spend the money. You know, if a whole movie was based on an aircraft carrier. And by the way, this happened once, okay? And they could not get the aircraft carrier. They just didn't do the movie. That's how powerful this guy was. You know, and that's in that book, Operation Hollywood, by David Robb, all right? So to me, this is really outrageous. And when I first found out about it, Lisa Pease told me about the Trisha Jenkins book, all right? And I read the book. I read the first edition. I understand she's come out with 2 later editions, which I unfortunately haven't been able to read yet. But in National Security Cinema, what he does there is he shows that the script of Charlie Wilson's War, in the early editions of that script, it was much more hard-hitting and honest about what really was happening in Afghanistan than the final product was. A guy named Milton Bearden, who was a CIA officer in that area of the world, is named as the CIA consultant on that picture. This information in National Security Cinema tells me that he had a lot more influence on that film than I allowed him for, okay? And I think this really shows Tom Hanks' cooperation with them on that picture and what him and Spielberg did in the post which is really incredible, and we'll talk about that later, you know, which is really an incredible depiction, you know, of what really happened with the Pentagon Papers. I mean, and this is the thing that is really kind of puzzling. People think that Hanks and Spielberg, they think of them as popular actors and directors, and they have this reputation as being liberal. Okay? You know? When I did this research on Charlie Wilson's War and the Post, I really couldn't understand this reputation that they have.
Well, I mean, Spielberg was a big supporter of the horrible, you know, excesses of the Bush administration and the Patriot Act in particular, that was an assault on civil liberties. I mean,
well, he was very late in coming out against that. Okay, they had to push him into coming out against that. Okay. You know, but to me, after doing this work, the best you can say about these guys, they're centrist Democrats. I would almost say that with how much the political spectrum has changed in the last 50 years, they're almost Eisenhower Republicans.
Right.
You know? Okay. You know? So let's start with the Post, because...
Well, I wanted to comment real quick, just in case.
Sure.
In case anyone in case the names are getting anyone mixed up, Phil Shrub is basically – he was the liaison for the Pentagon when it came to Hollywood and television. And Chase Brandon, that's the CIA liaison. I think he was 35 years as an officer in the CIA, and then he goes to Hollywood. So you know, those are the two names that are really important to understanding all of this. But go on. I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, that's fine. It's your show. Okay. What happened in the Post is that this is real. And by the way, I talked to the guy who was a lawyer for the New York Times at the time the whole Pentagon Papers case was shaping up. I think it's good. I think it's good to lay the background in first, so your listeners will understand.
I was going to say I have a lot of younger listeners that probably either don't know about the Pentagon Papers and Daniel Ellsberg and Mike Gravel, or they only saw the movie and they don't even know who Mike Gravel is, other than the meme president candidate. And I can tell you this: I know for a fact that Mike Gravel hates that movie, because I've talked to people on his campaign and he was very angry that he didn't get mentioned in it.
Well, he should be. Okay. See, to understand the Pentagon Papers, you have to understand that Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, was the Secretary of Defense under both Kennedy and Johnson. And it was about 7 or 8 years he was in office. Johnson essentially forced him out, okay, in 1967. Because McNamara had become so disenchanted with the Vietnam War, all right? Under Kennedy had decided that we were going to withdraw from Vietnam, okay? And McNamara was fully aware of this. He was fully cognizant of it. And at a meeting in Hawaii in May of 1963, he had asked for withdrawal schedules from everybody, every agency in South Vietnam, that is the CIA, the Pentagon, State Department, etc. These were handed in to him at this meeting. He looked them over, turned around and said, "It's too slow. We're getting out faster." All right. So then in October, Kennedy signs NSAM 263. Which says we will withdraw 1,000 troops by the end of this year, then 1,000 every month until the withdrawal is completed in early 1965. All right? Okay. And so this was what was happening. And McNamara was sent out to brief the press on this. All right? And Kennedy sticks his head out the door and says, "And tell them the helicopters are going too." All right? So... you know, so this was what was happening. Well, Johnson, to make a long story short, Johnson never agreed with that policy. All right. And he essentially told McNamara this, you know, when he took over, you know, that I never agreed with what you and Kennedy were doing in Vietnam. I thought it was bad psychologically. All right. But I just sat there, you know, because I was only the vice president. Words to that effect. So this policy got reversed under Johnson from about November, late November of 1963 to March of 1964. It becomes completely reversed with something called National Security Action Memorandum 288, which is in March of 1964, in which Johnson actually begins planning for airstrikes against targets in the north, okay, by American pilots, all right? And so Johnson then, of course, went ahead and timed the expansion of the war for the time that he was going to be elected, okay, his full term, okay, after the 1964 election. And the Tonkin Gulf incident of August 1964 gave him the pretext. Should I explain that?
Well, the Gulf of Tonkin, yeah, maybe just very briefly, because younger listeners need to know about it.
Okay. The Tonkin Gulf incident took place in August of 1964. There were two separate incidents in which Johnson claimed that American ships were attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin off the coast of North Vietnam on, I think, two nights that were, I think one was 2 days away from the other one. All right. He used this to get a declaration of what was the equivalent. He didn't like to call it a declaration of war.
But that's what it was.
Yeah. That's really what it was. Okay. All right. But what hardly anybody knows is it was written in advance of the incident. It was written in June. The incident was in August. This shows you how he was planning on expanding this war.
I remember when I first learned about it in history class in high school, there was like a little small section in the textbook about it. And I'm like, so they basically just like faked an event? And there's only a small paragraph about this? What?
Yeah. It's what caused the Vietnam War. Yeah. All right. And so it turned out that one of the incidents never happened. Okay. And it turned out that Johnson and McNamara were lying in the sense that they were not unprovoked attacks. Okay. That they were violating international waters off the coast of North Vietnam. And the destroyer ships were decked out with high level communications equipment. And they were accompanied by little speedboats that were supposed to go ahead and make attacks on North Vietnam. And what the whole idea was that the speedboats would then show where certain installations and radar was and the destroyer ship. So they, in essence, and by the way, McGeorge Bundy even said this, these were provocations. Okay. All right. So what happens is, Johnson then orders airstrikes against North Vietnam, okay, by American pilots. And the installations were planned on in advance by NSAM 288 because he had already picked out where he was going to attack. All right. And so this goes on. I think there were something like 60 sorties run that night. And Johnson couldn't wait to announce them. He actually announced them before some of the pilots hit their destinations. So in other words, the North Vietnamese anti-aircraft batteries were ready and two planes got shot down and two prisoners were taken. All right. And so that was essentially the pretext that Johnson was going to go ahead and expand the war. He was going to use the Tonkin Gulf resolution as a declaration of war. And this is what happens. Okay, this is what happens. The war begins in February of 1965. The first Marines land at Da Nang in March of 1965. And by the end of 65, there were something like 175,000 combat troops in Vietnam. There were none on the day that Kennedy was assassinated. All right. So what happens is that McNamara, after about a year in 1966, sees that this isn't working. Okay. That we're not going to be able to win this war. All right. And it doesn't matter. Rolling Thunder was the air operation that the Air Force had figured out. And this was tremendous bombing. But anybody could figure out what the heck is there to bomb in North Vietnam. It's not like Germany in 1944 and 1945 or Japan, where you had these huge urban things with weapons-making capacity, okay? And so McNamara had figured out that this was not going to work, all right? But Johnson would not listen to him. In fact, Johnson wouldn't listen to anybody. And so slowly, all of Kennedy's advisors, one by one, you know, George Ball, Pierre Salinger, McGeorge Bundy, you know, they leave the White House, all right? And so McNamara has this meeting with some of these guys, plus John Kenneth Galbraith in late 1966. And Galbraith said, I never seen McNamara so disturbed. You know, it was almost like he was being manic about what Johnson was forcing him to do, you know. And so McNamara then decided that he was going to leave behind a record of this folly, all right? So he secretly sanctions a top secret project, which is going to be a history of the war. And this history is going to go all the way back to the beginning. You know, how the United States got involved in support of the French regime, okay, in Vietnam, way back in the late 1940s, in support of the French attempt to retake its colony of Vietnam after World War II. It was going to be a comprehensive history of everything that Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy had done.
So McNamara is basically in the Pentagon seeing, you know, LBJ make huge follies, and he says, I'm going to make a paper trail, essentially. Right. Okay.
Yes, a complete comprehensive paper trail. And Leslie Galb, the editor of the Pentagon Papers, said whenever he had a problem getting a document, he would call up McNamara, and 5 minutes later, he'd have the document. Okay? So the Pentagon Papers, I think the complete Pentagon Papers is something like 4 volumes long. And each section has a narrative it tells, and then you have the backup documents right after the narrative. All right? And it's pretty much a complete political and military history of our involvement in the Vietnam War. And it was classified top secret, and McNamara deliberately did not want Johnson to know about it, okay? Because he knew what would happen if Johnson would know about it.
So he's going over Johnson's head, basically.
Right. Okay, it was not authorized by the White House. All right. Now, one of the guys who worked on part of the Pentagon Papers was an analyst from Rand Corporation on the West Coast named Daniel Ellsberg. All right. Daniel Ellsberg had actually been in Vietnam. All right. I think he went over in like 64, 65, because he wanted to get a look at what the heck was really happening. All right. And he had been more or less a hawk on the war. But once he went over there, I think he was there for a year and a half, and he came back and he realized this is complete propaganda. We're not doing anything over there, you know. Okay, it's a complete and utter failure of what we're doing, you know. And so he saw that, you know, the casualty figures were rigged. He saw that patrols that were supposed to be made were not being made. He saw that secured areas that the United States said it has were not secured. And he found, most of all, that the South Vietnamese army was a joke. You know, we weren't building an independent country in South Vietnam. That if it wasn't for the United States, you know, South Vietnam would simply collapse, you know, on its own. So he had access to the Pentagon Papers because there was a set at Rand Corporation, all right? And he and Anthony Russo, who worked with him there, decided that they were going to go ahead and copy night after night, day after day, week after week. They would take home volumes and copy this thing, all right? And after about a month, you know, they had a complete set, all right? And so Ellsberg decided that the most effective way to get this message out there was to give it to somebody in Congress and have them read it on the floor of the Capitol building, because elected senators and congressmen have immunity from prosecution if what they're saying is on the floor of either the Senate or the House. All right. Well, the problem is they couldn't get anybody to do it. They went to about, and by the way, this is completely left out of the film. Spielberg and Hanks, and I'll tell you something else. When I talked to the attorney from the New York Times, he told me that Spielberg had sent him the first draft of the script. He said, Jim, Ellsberg wasn't in it. The only scene Ellsberg was in was that scene where Kate Graham and the Washington Post people watch him on TV speaking. I said, what? And he said, yeah. He goes, and so I raised a real ruckus about this. I said, how the hell can you tell the story of the Pentagon Papers if you don't have Ellsberg in the movie?
Well, I was going to comment real quick on that in that regard. Sorry. This movie, The Post, first off, as far as I understand it, the Ellsberg, as a character in this movie, Ellsberg's in it for like, what, 10, maybe 15 minutes max?
At the most 15 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, and then also, the story is told from the perspective of the Washington Post, and it's basically told over the course of like, what, a few weeks? Meanwhile, yes. This story goes back years.
Yes, yes. And that's one of the worst things there is about this movie, is that if you take a look at the actual time period that the main part of the story is told, it's approximately 3 weeks. But this story goes back years, because like I was just commenting, Ellsberg couldn't get anybody to read it. He went to about four different people, including George McGovern, including Pete McCloskey, okay? And none of them wanted to do it, all right?
Now, why do you mention those two in particular for listeners that may be younger? Why George McGovern and Pete McCloskey
because
in particular?
Because he thought that McGovern had designs of running for the presidency, okay? And this is about 1969 or 1970. And which, of course, he did. And so that's why he didn't want to do it. McCloskey was a Republican, but he thought McCloskey was much more liberal than he ended up being. And so he was kind of a moderate Republican, okay, who didn't want to go up against Nixon. All right. And so he finally found a guy who was willing to do it. And this was the senator from Alaska, Mike Gravel. All right. And Gravel told him, okay, I'll start reading these things. So Gravel braced himself, and for about 4 hours one night, he starts reading this record into the congressional record, all right, which explodes the story, okay? All right.
He did it. When I interviewed him about it, he said he read it until he was exhausted.
Right, he was. And then he entered the volumes into the record, which you're allowed to do. All right. Now, meantime, Ellsberg, and by the way, that's all cut out of the movie. All right.
Yeah, Mike Gravel isn't even in it.
Yeah, right. So then, meantime, Ellsberg is trying to get a guy he knows from the New York Times, Neil Sheehan, interested in the story. So I think Ellsberg at this time was teaching a class at Harvard or something, and he invites Sheehan up to Cambridge, and he gives him some of the papers, and then he says, okay, I'm leaving for the weekend. Okay, just read what you want, okay, and then just tell me if you're interested. Well, of course, Sheehan stole the papers, okay, all right, and he brings them back to the New York Times, and there's a huge debate. I mean, a really powerful debate in the New York Times whether to print this or not, okay? And by the way, this is how it took 3 months for the New York Times to decide whether or not to print the Pentagon Papers, okay? All right, you don't see any of that in the movie. All you see is Ben Bradley, played by Tom Hanks, saying, I think the Post has this stuff, okay? And I need to send a spy up there. And by the way, none of that ever happened, okay? And so what happens is, The reporters and the editors threatened to resign at the New York Times, all right? And so then Punch Sulzberger, the owner of the Times, decides, okay, we're going to print the stories. So they print the stories, and then I think on the third day, the attorney general – okay, the Attorney General's office calls up the New York Times and says, we request that you stop printing these on grounds of national security. All right, which is really weird because the Pentagon Papers end in 1967. Now, we're talking about 1970, 71, the time frame this happens in. So what national security was there in 1967? To protect, all right? And by the way, that point's never brought up either in the movie, all right? By the way, I had to see the movie twice to really
I salute your efforts having to watch this thing. Oh, my God.
Okay, to see just how bad this was. All right, so what happened then is that since the Times refused, they were then a cease and desist order was sent up by the Attorney General's office. And the Times decided to obey the cease and desist order. Okay? All right. So what then happens is that Ben Bajdikian, who was a friend of Daniel Ellsberg, decides to call him. He works for the Post. All right? And he says, I think that the Post will print these if you give them to us. So Ben Bajdikian goes ahead, gets the papers, and this is how the Post got the papers. All right? And so, of course, the same thing that happened at the Times happened to the Post. Okay? And one of the things, they were stopped also. So one of the things that was so outrageous about the movie is that in a scene in the movie, Ben Bajdikian brings in this bag full of papers, gives it to Hanks. Hanks gives it to Graham, K. Graham, played by Meryl Streep. And all these papers, we're supposed to think that somehow Katharine Graham inspired these other people to go ahead. No. What really happened is that by this time, Daniel Ellsberg had a fleet of students helping him copy, and he had made several copies of the Pentagon Papers, so that I think the total was 17, and he had sent them to all these different publications, and that's how they got out there, and that's not in the movie either. Okay.
Well, it's interesting because not to interrupt you, but I feel like the response that you know, fans of this movie or even Spielberg himself maybe would have is, well, we took dramatic licenses. And, you know, this movie is meant to reflect the times we live in with the attacks on the press by Trump. So we wanted to make a movie about how the press is so important. But the thing is, it wasn't really all the press that got this out there. It was a good citizen in Ellsberg and his students.
Right,
so, I mean,
right.
You know, the press is important to getting information out there, but sometimes they're trying to squash the story. And, you know,
right.
We should tell the truth about that.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I want to sum up the movie with is probably what I thought was, and this is why I had to see the picture twice, $14 a piece. I felt like, you know, calling Hanks, hey, you owe me $28. All right, so there's a scene in the movie where Graham, K. Graham, goes to McNamara's house. And she has this big confrontation scene. Like, how could you have been involved with this? You know, that kind of thing, you know. And he warns her not to publish them, you know, the papers, because Nixon will see. There is no way in the world a dramatic license would sponsor something like that, because dramatic license, you have to be consistent. It might not have happened quite that way, but it has to be consistent with the character. Okay. And this was a complete adulteration of both these people. The idea that Katharine Graham was simply appalled by what the United States had done in Vietnam is a myth. It's absurd, because in the summer of 1964, when we discussed, Johnson knew he was going to go into Vietnam, he had a meeting with Kay Graham and the major editors of the Post. And he told them, I'm going to expand the war after I'm elected. So she knew, not only did she know that Johnson was going to expand the war, but she also had to know that he was lying on the campaign trail. Because if you remember back to the things that Johnson was saying, I'm not going to send American boys over to fight a war that Asian boys should. That kind of thing. He said that several times on the campaign trail. So, and he, by the way, he also said later that Kay Graham is worth two divisions to me in her support of the war. The Washington Post supported the entire escalation of that war. So when she goes over and says that, oh, where did they get that? That's a complete reversal of the factual record. Secondly, Bob McNamara never inhibited anybody from publishing those papers, okay? There's nothing in the record at all, okay, that he ever did any such thing, you know? All right? So that's a complete reversal of both of those characters in order to make this false heroine out of Kate Graham. You know, and so, you know, I just, to me, it was really, really insulting to have to watch this thing. And it really wasn't Bradley and Graham who were the heroes. It was really Daniel Ellsberg and Anthony Russo. Because what the film leaves out also, Nixon prosecuted both of those guys.
Yeah, right. Wasn't Ellsberg called the most dangerous man in America by Nixon?
Right, right.
Yeah.
He ordered the Justice Department under John Mitchell to prosecute Ellsberg and Russo. This went on until, I think, 72 or 73. And Ellsberg and Russo actually had a trial, all right? And it was short-circuited when the White House made a deal with the judge to give him a promotion, and it was found out that Howard Hunt, working for the White House, had broken in to Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office in Los Angeles. All right. And so it was called off in mid-trial. All right. And so, but I should say that Arthur Schlesinger testified at that trial. And he said, this is one of the first times it was said for the record in public, that Kennedy would have never expanded the Vietnam War. Okay. And he actually worked in the White House. So that's all. See, the only way you could do the complete story of the Pentagon Papers is as a miniseries.
Right.
You know, it would have to be like about three nights long, 2 hours a night. That's the only way you could tell the whole story. You know, and so what they did in that movie, The Post, Spielberg and Hanks, was I wouldn't even call it a Cliff Notes version. You know, I would call it a censored Cliff Notes version of what really happened, you know. And so, but that's, I think that's Tom Hanks and that's Steven Spielberg.
I wanted to add, you know, we're going to talk about Charlie Wilson's War in a second here. I want to discuss that a little bit more in depth. But with The Post is almost the culmination of what you were talking about with what figures like Jim Shrub and Chase Brandon wanted. You know, this is a movie that worships institutions. It's not the whistleblowers that are the heroes. No, it's the institution of the press, which, you know, at the time, the press was involved with Operation Mockingbird. So right. you had the CIA right. working with the press at the time. But you're not supposed to think about those things. We have to worship the good institutions like the CIA and the New York Times. Don't mm-hmm. question the man behind the curtain. And that's the culmination. You get movies like this that don't want you to question anything. There's no questioning of anything allowed.
See, and the worst thing about it is that it tried to make heroes out of Ben Bradley and Cary Grant against the backdrop of the Vietnam War. Oh, my God. You know, I mean, that is to show you how bad the Washington Post was. The guy they had on the Saigon beat actually tried to say that Tet wasn't really a victory for Hanoi. Okay, that's how bad the Washington, that's how much they supported Johnson's complete escalation of that war. You know, and what makes it even worse when you think about it is that Ben Bradley had been friends with JFK, you know, and there's a section in the Pentagon Papers which addresses the attempted withdrawal from Vietnam. Okay. Now, did Ben Bradley ever print that part? No, he didn't. Okay. So that's the kind of friend Ben Bradley was to John F. Kennedy. All right. And to make heroes and heroines out of people who supported that war, which cost the lives of 58,000 Americans and something like 3 to 4 million Vietnamese. Okay. And if you add in what happened in Cambodia, which I think you have to, because it was the invasion of Cambodia, which eventually led to the fall of Sihanouk, the rise of Lon Nol and his replacement by the Khmer Rouge. Okay. Then you're talking another 1 or 2 million. All right. So, you know, it's just a complete travesty if you really want to look at it in its starkest terms. But that's what you're dealing with. You know, these are the so-called liberals. You
know? Right. Well, that's the thing. People will say, oh, well, it's a dramatization. It's just a movie. It's not supposed to be taken as history. But when people watch these movies nowadays, they're like, oh, this is what actually happened. You know, especially younger people. And it becomes, it's revisionist history. That's what it is.
Right. And so what it does is it completely reverses the template. Okay. And by the way, there's a very short sequence in the film where Russo and Ellsberg are copying, which they actually try to say Kennedy was supporting the war. There's a brief vignette in there, about 5 seconds, which I didn't mention in my review, but I did mention in my book. I spent a few pages on the post in the JFK assassination, the evidence today, because I was trying to show, you know, this is what passes for liberalism, you know, in Hollywood today, you know, and it's to say that it's not is, I think, an understatement, because what they're really doing, like you just mentioned, they're supporting the status quo. They're supporting the institutions that got us into that mess to begin with.
Well, it's like, I want to mention Mike Gravel real quick again, because, you know, I see how the media looked at him during this election, and he didn't really think he was going to become a Democratic, you know, candidate or anything. The reason he did that election was to help some kids out that were just getting out of high school, and now they're running an institute, the Gravel Institute. He helped launch their careers, basically. And, you know, the thing is, people want to look at Gravel and say, oh, look at the funny candidate. He's an eccentric old man. I'm thinking to myself, he's done more than a lot of you have. And yet we turn these heroic people into, you know, jokes, or we make fun of them in the media. That's how bad it's gotten. And yeah, it's these so-called liberals are the ones that are doing it. You know, I think Hollywood has become right wing.
Mike Gravel is one of the – there aren't that many heroes in the whole Pentagon Papers affair, you know. But Mike Gravel is one of them. You know, there's Ellsberg, there's Russo, and there's Gravel, who actually put their careers on the line to get the Pentagon Papers out there. And the fact that Russo and Gravel are not even – I don't even think they're mentioned in the movie, let alone depicted, okay? And they – and Ellsberg had to be forced into the movie, you know. I mean, that kind of shows you what they were trying to do. And I believe, you know, that I don't think I'm too much off base in saying this. It's really a falsification of history. You know, they might have gotten some things correct, you know, throughout the movie, but the overall picture is really a falsification of what happened. And, you know, and people forget that war went on till 1975. The Pentagon Papers didn't stop that war. Okay. It went on till 1975, you know, with the complete collapse of, just like Ellsberg had said, with the complete collapse of Saigon. All right. And its complete fall, you know, to Hanoi. Because the United States had withdrawn, you know, and that's what he was saying. You know, he in one of his lectures that he gave, he said, you know, to look at the United States as solving the problem in Southeast Asia is completely false. It'd be more accurate to say we are part of the problem in Southeast Asia. Okay, you know, and today. I know I was having dinner one night with a friend of mine in Long Beach, and we went to this pho restaurant, which means Vietnamese food. And so we're sitting down there, and I asked the guy, I said, the manager, I said, do you ever go over to Vietnam? And he goes, oh, yeah, all the time, about once every 2 months. And I go, well, where do you go? And he goes, Saigon, they call it Ho Chi Minh City today, you know. And I said, well, what's it like? If you go there, what you see is McDonald's, Ben and Jerry's, Bank of America. I go, are you serious? He goes, yeah. And I said to my friend, we spent all those years fighting that war, all those dead Americans, all those dead Vietnamese, and for this? Is that what they meant by the domino theory? They wanted Domino's pizza in Saigon?
So that brings me around. You mentioned the falsification of history. I want to get into this if you got the time. I was really interested in covering Charlie Wilson's War, 2007. It's based on the U.S. Congressman Charlie Wilson, another Tom Hanks movie, right? Produced by him, starring him, Julia Roberts, Philip Seymour Hoffman, huge all-star cast. And it's about, U.S. Congressman Charlie Wilson and CIA operative Gust Avrakatos and their efforts involving Operation Cyclone, which basically involved supporting the Mujahideen during the Soviet-Afghan conflict. And if people don't know what that led to, maybe we can talk a little bit about that, because he's portrayed as a hero in this movie, and yet, you know, what did this lead to in real life?
Don't forget Herring.
Right.
Okay. Herring was played by Julia Roberts. All right. Now, this is, and you're right. See, this was a complete Tom Hanks production. So he can't say I was just acting in it, okay? Because it was produced by Playtone, which is his production company. So it was his baby, you know, from the him and Gary Goldsman. It was his baby, you know, from the beginning. They bought a book by a guy named George Kreil, who was a kind of freelance reporter, right? And he eventually went to work for CBS in 60 Minutes, all right? And one of his early segments on 60 Minutes was about this guy named Charlie Wilson, who was a representative from Texas. And it showed him running around with the Afghan rebels on horseback, okay? And there's no other way to say this. It portrayed Wilson as somehow a one-man hero mission to the Afghanis, the Afghan rebels who wanted to overthrow the Soviets, right? And you know, and you can look it up online. I'm pretty sure you can look it up on YouTube, all right? The only note of reservation came at the very end of the segment when Harry Reasoner said a couple sentences. He said, "The people that the Pakistanis are training hate the United States as much as they hate the Russians." And that was it. That was it. That's the only thing, the word of caution that was said. All right. Now, Kreil then wrote a book called Charlie Wilson's War. And I'm exaggerating very slightly when I say, if you read that book, you would think that the whole effort to get the Russians out of Afghanistan was run by those three people. Go ahead. If you don't believe me, read the book. All right.
Yeah, I'm sure they don't mention Zbigniew Brzezinski and Under Carter.
And of course, that's more or less what the movie says. All right. In reality, and again, I wrote a whole chapter on this in the JFK assassination, The Evidence Today. This goes back to the Carter administration, all right? And as you mentioned, Brzezinski, his national security advisor, advised him to send the CIA into Afghanistan to organize resistance. Now, why is that so important? Because of this. The Russians hadn't invaded yet. The Russians had not invaded the country yet. And then in an interview he gave years later, they asked him, why'd you advise Carter to send the CIA into Afghanistan before the Russians invaded? And he said, well, I thought this would be a way to give the Soviet Union its own Vietnam War. Now, really, when you think of this, this is perfectly fits the old saying that the Cold Warriors are always fighting the last war. Okay? In other words, Brzezinski was so intent on going ahead and bringing the Soviet Union into Afghanistan that he seemed to be completely unaware that by doing that, you were going to unleash a whole new war, this time against Islamic fundamentalism. All right?
Let's be clear here. I mean, this is the origins of, like, bin Laden, basically, that we're talking about here.
Yes. There's no doubt about this. All right? And so what makes this even worse is that there were signs, because Afghanistan was being run by two men, who sponsored a revolution, and they were socialists. They really weren't communists, all right? But there were places within Afghanistan that resisted some of the reforms that they were trying to do. Specifically, they did not, the Islamic fundamentalists did not want women educated, which is what these guys were trying to do. So even then, there were traces that there was going to be an Islamic uprising. Okay. So what Carter, it's, why did Carter do this? One way to look at it is that he thought that by looking strong against this, what was happening in Afghanistan, that it would make up for what had happened with the Shah of Iran. All right? Because Carter had actually visited the Shah something like 8 months before his overthrow. Okay? And he had been advised to do that by Brzezinski. All right? And so what was happening in Iran was making him look pretty stupid. Okay? And so what he does then instead, he decides to come out very strong against what was going to be the Soviet invasion by Brezhnev into Afghanistan. All right? So then what happens? Carter loses the election. All right? Is William Casey even mentioned in Charlie Wilson's War, the movie? I don't remember him. Did you remember him being mentioned?
I don't either, actually.
Because I don't remember him being mentioned in the film. All right. When William Casey became CIA director, him and Robert McFarlane, the national security advisor, it's those two guys who decide to ramp up the CIA operation in Afghanistan way beyond what Carter and Brzezinski had planned. And in a little piece of notation found at the Reagan Library, the late, great Robert Perry found a note, okay, which he thinks was written by a major CIA officer, or excuse me, written to Walter Raymond, a major CIA officer from McFarland, and it said words of the effect, I think we should contact Congressman Wilson from Texas. I think he can help us a lot in getting money through Congress for our Afghan operations. In other words, the idea that this was Charlie Wilson by himself out there in the plains of Afghanistan is simply not accurate, okay? It was really the Casey and McFarlane manipulating Wilson to go ahead and begin his visits over there to be more or less a front man for what was going to be an incredible escalation of what Carter had begun. And that is what happened. And they did not directly aid the Afghan rebels. They went through Pakistan, which was another fundamentalist country, Islamic country, led by General Zia. The problem is General Zia wanted almost complete control, okay, of everything that was coming into his country, all right? And since Pakistan was a fundamentalist country, Saudi Arabia decided that we will match whatever the United States appropriates for this clandestine war. Well, it turned out that you were talking in just a few years, you were talking about hundreds of millions of dollars now that are going into this thing. All kinds of weapons, all kinds of training, all controlled by Pakistan. All right. So obviously, the fact that Pakistan was a Muslim fundamentalist country attracted those kinds of people to the cause. And this is where Osama bin Laden got his start. Okay. Was in this war against the Soviet demon. All right. And so this is something that, if I remember correctly, Kreil did not mention in his book. I don't think Osama bin Laden is in the Kreil book. Okay. And he's not specifically mentioned in the film. All right. And so what happens is that through all of this money, through all this technology, et cetera, that the CIA is beginning to help with, and it wasn't simply one CIA guy like Charlie Wilson's war. It came from the top, William Casey. All right. All right. They begin to turn the tide. Okay. And the Soviets have to send in, I think the Soviets at the pinnacle had 110,000 men in Afghanistan, right? And so they decide that it's not going to work, okay? Gorbachev comes into power. I'm talking about 1985 now, okay? And Gorbachev tries to get a truce. All right. Gorbachev tried a little bit with super elite commando troops. They weren't very effective because by this time the CIA was giving the I think it was a Mujahideen. Isn't that what we called them? All right. Had given them Stinger missiles. Stinger missiles are shoulder launched rockets that can bring down helicopters. OK. And this was a very key instrument. OK. In stopping the Soviet takeover, all right? And so what happened is Gorbachev tried to get a truce. And the truce he tried to get was with a guy, Nablusjah, that he had set up, okay, with the moderate forces in Afghanistan. One of the dumbest things that the United States ever did was turn down that offer. Because we were backing the nutcases, Hektemar and Haqqani.
We were backing what would eventually lead to 9/11.
Our side was backing the nutcases, Hektemar and Haqqani, who were the extremist Islamic fundamentalists, the nutcases, really crazy people. And by the way, I say that because I know somebody in the NSA who worked there at the time, and that's what he called them, you know, all right? We did not back, as the film tries to say, we did not back Massoud. Massoud was the moderate guy, okay, who I think Haqqani had assassinated. All right. See, Massoud was the guy that the United States should have been backing from the beginning, okay, because he could have appealed to both sides. He could have gotten a settlement. He held off the capital, Kabul, from an attack from the fundamentalists for something like a year. He held them off. All right. And so finally, the United Nations wanted that deal. The United States and Charlie Wilson, and let's not forget, Charlie Wilson, decided to turn down the deal. This led to the fall of Nablusjah, okay, the guy the Soviet Union wanted to leave behind, after 3 years, and then the complete takeover and the descent of Afghanistan into a giant, bloody mess of a civil war. Okay. Along the way, General Zia requested atomic weapons. Can you imagine this? Giving atomic weapons to a fundamentalist Islamic state? Well, nobody knows for sure. I think Charlie Wilson tried to get it for him, okay? But it didn't matter because he ended up somehow, some way. I suspect the CIA helped him. All right. If you look at it today, Pakistan has 80 atomic weapons. All right. And on top of that, they did not sign the non-proliferation treaty. All right. This is how crazy this whole thing ended up being. You know, now, as an end story, it turns out that Charlie Wilson, to say the least, was not doing this for altruistic reasons as depicted in the film.
Oh, in the film, he's not only a super patriot, but he's also strapped for cash. He's only getting paid $700 a week, which isn't the truth.
The thing is, he had stock holdings in an oil company that he wrote down on his every year congressmen have to do this, that was worth between $100,000 and $250,000. He cashed those out to another oil company which had dealings with Zia, because Zia was trying to get an oil pipeline through Pakistan. He cashed out at something like $700,000 on that. And of course, then he retired from Congress and he became a lobbyist for Afghanistan and Pakistan, raking in $360,000 a year. In other words, Charlie Wilson became a millionaire. Okay. And Herring, her husband, was a big oil executive also. And she tried to get a conference with Zia or his ambassador to do an oil deal, okay, with her husband. Now, her husband passed away, and that company eventually turned into Enron, okay? All right, it was bought by Enron, all right? So, you know, when when you look at this thing in all of its, you know, with let's say the declassified version, all right, it really is not what it's presented to be, you know, and in some ways it's just as bad as the Post, all right, because if you look at it, the complete miscalculation of what we were doing there and our refusal to go along with Gorbachev's deal, I mean, it began the explosion of this war on terror. And I Brzezinski, actually, when he was asked this later, he said words of the effect that he thought it was worth it, even if it did cause the war on terror. Well, that's really stupid, because Gorbachev was reforming the Soviet Union anyway. Okay? I mean, you didn't need to go ahead and do this whole bloody business and keep it going and turn down his deal, etc. Okay? You didn't have to do that because it was going to come anyway. You know? See, and I have to say, I believe that when the Reagan administration turned down Gorbachev's deal in Iceland, the famous Reykjavik conference, where Gorbachev wanted to cut 50% off of all atomic weapons, et cetera, okay? I think that, plus the turn down of the deal in Afghanistan, I believe that weakened Gorbachev. Every time he tried to intervene in something to try and reform it, to try and make it better, it ended up weakening him. I mean, he even decided he was going to give up some of the Baltic states. Okay. And I think that weakened him, and that allowed for the right wing attempted coup, you know, against Gorbachev, you know, which brought us the drunken fool Yeltsin. Okay. Which ended up, you know, a horrendous tragedy for the Soviet Union. You know, Boris Yeltsin was the most incompetent, the most corrupt, you know, the most despotic leader especially when you compare him to Gorbachev. And he essentially, you know, ran Russia into the ground. I mean, he sent them back to the, to call it the Great Depression in Russia, the economic chaos, that was is an understatement. It was even worse than the Great Depression that those people had to go through. But see, this is part of the ramification. Now, the only thing that I think the film says is that during congressional hearings, Charlie Wilson tried to set up schools or something in Afghanistan, okay, and somehow that didn't turn out well. Well, in my book, I say, look, at the time frame they're talking about, that's not what Charlie Wilson was advocating. Charlie Wilson was just like the CIA in that he wanted to keep on backing Haqqani and Hektemar. He actually called Massoud a communist collaborator. All right. So the glorification of Charlie Wilson, you know, in that film and in Kreil's book.
Now, I want to note something real quick for my listeners. In the book, you know, there's an epilogue where Kreil sort of says, you know, this may have not ended up all, you know, on the up and up, and, it led to some problems. But in the movie, there's 20 seconds of dialogue. 20 seconds saying, now there's some crazy fundamentalists we have to worry about down the line.
Right. They more or less ignored it. Okay. I mean, if you're telling me 20 seconds is supposed to make up for what happened, no. I mean, at least Kreil put in about 15 pages, you know. For 500 pages, the guy says Charlie Wilson is great. And then for 15 pages, he says, well, maybe not so great, you know. But in the movie, you know, I mean, it's just about ignoring. And isn't the last scene this big rally at CIA headquarters where Herring's there and the other people, and they're applauding? Isn't that how it ends, if I remember correctly? Yeah. So till the very end, you know, there's Charlie Wilson accepting all this applause. And I said in my book, I said, for what? I mean, this is like George Bush landing on that aircraft carrier saying mission accomplished when the Iraq war is just beginning, you know? So
I was going to say real quick too, the thing about like, you know, he wanted to set up schools, but it didn't really work out and all this stuff. I mean, you know, people are very upset now that, Trump has betrayed the Kurds. That's what we did in Afghanistan after we were done with the Soviet-Afghan conflict. We just let it devolve into civil war and a blood massacre.
Right. I mean, and Zia set up, what are those called? Madrasas? Yeah, that are supposed to educate. That's what he set up because we cut him in on so much power. Okay. You know, and even I think Benazir Bhutto, who later took over and was later assassinated, she told the White House, you know, in I think it's exact quote, you've created a Frankenstein, okay, in Afghanistan, you know, and then she got assassinated, you know, so you know, that's what really happened. And I believe that Milton Burden was the CIA consultant on Charlie Wilson's war, and in the Alfred Secker book, National Security Cinema.
The Tom Secker book. Yeah, yeah.
Is that his name? Yeah, Tom. Yeah, you're
Alfred,
right.
Matthew Alfred and Tom Secker. Yeah.
Okay. They said that Mike Nichols, the director, actually tried to be a little bit more honest, but every script that was turned in was then revised until you ended up with what I consider a whitewash. You know, that's what happened. So it's not like Mike Nichols didn't want to do something, you know, that had more bite to it, had more realism to it. But evidently somebody, maybe Chase Brandon, you know, somebody someplace, you know, said, no, Mike, we're not going down that route. Okay. And I think I have a comment in my book where somebody from the production office says, how do you deal with 9/11? You know, I mean, you know, they just didn't want to deal with that at all.
The thing I don't get is why is it? I mean, in your book, you know, the two names that come up are Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg. Why do these two figures keep making films that are basically revisionist history, support the status quo, worship the institutions, don't question authority? Why do they keep popping up when it comes to this issue?
No, that's a very good question. It's a very, very good question. I mean, Spielberg, of course, you know, I mean, what do you say? But the guy's one of the most powerful people there is in Hollywood. Okay, he's really the guy behind the throne, the whole AFI thing. You know, he's very influential in that. Okay, he has a lot of political clout. Him and his wife give literally hundreds of thousands of dollars every year. They arrange dinners, okay, and with the Hollywood elite. And Hanks is right behind them, you know. And what I said once is, if you truly really believe that Bill Clinton and Barack Obama are the best people that we can offer, then in my opinion, you're not a very liberal person. Or was it the new Cold War? You can't use liberal anymore. It's progressive. Okay. You're not a very progressive person.
Well, I was going to say, for me, when I think of liberal Hollywood, by which I mean progressive, the people I think of are like Ed Asner is very much a progressive. He does actual
right.
activism.
Right.
Martin Sheen protests
yes.
wars in the streets.
Yes.
Even I know she's hated, but even someone like Jane Fonda, she still does activism. I know people hate her for Vietnam, although I think that gets over-mythologized. But those, to me, are the progressive Hollywood, not Spielberg and not Tom Hanks.
Yes, yes. Yeah. People like, you know, and Ed Asner, he was essentially kicked out of the Screen Actors Guild. He won an election or something, you know, and then somehow they got rid of him. They didn't want him. And just because he was so outspoken, you know, just because of that, you know, and you're absolutely right. You know, Jane Fonda, she's not as active now as she was then, but she was just let me tell you a little story about Jane Fonda. Back in her activist days, she made a nationwide tour of the United States. I think this was about in 1971 or 72. And she spoke at a college in my hometown, little dumpy Erie, Pennsylvania, population about 135,000. Okay. There was a line to get in there that was at least three blocks long. They had to turn them away. Okay. I ended up not getting in there. All right. And she had brought these Vietnam veterans against the war with her. And they were showing, I talked to somebody who got inside, they were showing all the horrible weapons that United States combat troops were using in Vietnam. You know, grenades that were, they would explode, and it wasn't a nitroglycerin or TNT explosion. There was pieces of shrapnel built in, you know, that anybody within a range of 100 yards, you know, would get these horrible wounds in them, you know, okay, and all these other weapons that were being, kinds of bombs, you know, that were being arranged for. And she was showing this stuff, you know, in front of a packed audience. There must have been probably about 1,000 people there, you know. And she did that for about 6 months, you know, when she could have been making like two movies, you know, $1 million a movie. You know, and she ended up touring the United States for 6 months. Spread, and I'll never forget our newspaper the morning after. Oh, my God. They just lambasted her, you know. But that's, she was willing to do that, you know, to end up stopping that war. And so, see, those are the kind of people who really put something on the line, you know, now those are liberal people. Those are progressive people, you know. I mean, to me, you know, donating your money to dog shelters, you know, and things like that, or saving whales, all right, you know, that's all good and kind. But That's not the kind of progressive people that I am. Martin Sheen is just phenomenal. I mean, he's been arrested like 63 times, you know, in anti-war protests. You know, just a terrific guy.
Well, the other thing is, I mean, there are some films that are sort of anti-establishment, but from that progressive end, but you just never hear about them. I mean, I'm not saying it was a great film, but Brian De Palma did that movie during the Iraq War days.
Redacted.
Redacted. You didn't hear about it. You heard about Zero Dark Thirty till the end of time, but not Redacted. And then, you know, Kill the Messenger, the Gary Webb biopic. You barely heard anything about it. It was like, you know, in and out. No one talked about it.
Yeah. Kill the Messenger was a terrific movie. I mean, that should have been nominated for about 5 Oscars, okay? And if you haven't seen it, please do, okay? Or read the book, because it tells one of the most important stories, you know, of the last 20 years, all right? How Gary Webb, a reporter for the San Jose Mercury News, discovered a cocaine dealing ring within the ranks of the CIA-backed Contras, and how they were selling cocaine in order to finance this war against the Sandinista government, okay, down in Nicaragua, okay? And just through some very, as they call in the trade, shoe leather, you know, going where other places, other reporters weren't going, finding sources other people weren't, he uncovered this bombshell report for the San Jose Mercury News. I think it was, wasn't it 4 parts? I think it was
in 4 Dark parts. Alliance.
Yes. Yeah. All right. And what happened afterwards was nothing less than a tragedy. Okay. His career was ruined because of this. All right. The New York Times jumped on him. The LA Times jumped on him. The Washington Post jumped on him. And it was essentially open season.
And what was interesting is my understanding was that he may have had one source that was wrong about something. And then they just went after him. And then, at, you know, years later, the Kerry Commission on Iran-Contra is like, well, basically he was right. And then Gary Webb ends up, his life's ruined.
Right. He ends up losing his job. Okay. He ends up getting a divorce from his wife. He ends up reporting for some little weekly magazine, which he made like maybe 25% of what he'd been making before. I mean, he had hoped, Gary Webb had hoped eventually of going into the real big leagues. That's what he wanted to do, you know, but his whole career was completely curtailed. And that movie, unlike what we're talking about with the Post, okay, or Charlie Wilson's War, that movie, Kill the Messenger, was an honest depiction of what happened. I reviewed it for Consortium News, if you want to look up that review. And I said, you know, Jeremy Leonard deserves all kinds of kudos, you know, for producing this thing and getting it made and into an honest rendition of what that story is really all about. So see, that to me, that's an honest, liberal, whatever you want to call it, progressive view of the facts of a tragic story. You know, and if you ask me, Spielberg or Tom Hanks would never go near something like that. You know, Tom Hanks ended up producing Parkland. Okay. When he bought Bugliosi's book, Reclaiming History, evidently, because the Pacific didn't do very well, that was the Hanks's big mega production, okay, the Pacific, which cost an incredible amount of money for a miniseries. In my book, I did some work on it. It was like $200 million, okay, for that miniseries. And it was essentially about the United States in the war against Japan. It didn't do that well ratings-wise. And so what they did is eventually HBO decided to back out of doing Reclaiming History, Bugliosi's book on the JFK case is almost 2,700 pages long. Unfortunately, I'm one of maybe five people in America who read every page. All right.
How does that stack up to the Warren Commission report?
It's pretty much a match pair. Okay. Two jokers on each side. All right. So, so he was going to do this mini series based upon that book. All right. And from my sources inside the film industry, HBO decided, no, we're not going to do it. Too expensive. All right. And it's not going to justify all the tens of millions of dollars we're going to spend on it, you know? And so what he ended up doing was making this crappy film, Parkland, okay, which is, if you can believe it, that's what it's about. It's about Kennedy's assassination in Dallas, how he goes to Parkland Hospital, they try and save him, and how Abraham Zapruder made a film and how the film was purchased, and then they leave Dallas, and Oswald is assassinated, and they show the burial of Oswald, and that's it. And they did a whole movie on this.
And how much? How much? What was the budget for it?
I don't know how much it cost, but I do know this: Hank sold off a large portion of the film to two other companies. Okay, because he knew it was going to bomb. The night that I saw it at a theater down in Long Beach, there were four people in the audience. Okay, four people in the audience. If I remember correctly, it didn't even do $1 million worth in the United States. Now, of course, you have overseas rights, and of course you have DVD rights, and of course you have television rights. But when a movie doesn't even break $1 million in the United States, I mean, that's really pretty bad. You know?
So I just looked it up. So Parkland was made on a budget of $10 million. Kill the Messenger was made on a budget of $5 million. I feel like it should be the other way around.
They did Kill the Messenger for $5 million?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, that's really cheap.
Well, yeah. I wanted to say about Kill the Messenger, I get very aggravated with people when they talk about Gary Webb because, you know, Dark Alliance does not even necessarily go as far as some people do when it comes to the CIA and drugs. He's not really saying like, oh, they were, you know, trafficking the drugs everywhere. He was, you know, at most, he would go as far as to say they looked the other way and allowed,
right.
you know...
Right.
these drug traffickers to traffic as long as they were funding the Contras.
Right.
You know, Gary Webb was a very good journalist. And, mm-hmm. you know, we get a low-budget movie about his life, but Parkland, oh, $10 million and Tom mm-hmm. Hanks. It's yeah. beyond me.
And Parkland was a pretty horrible movie. All right, it was really bad. And, you know, everybody probably knew it was going to bomb, okay? But Hanks went ahead and did, but he protected himself, like I said, by selling off the rights, you know, to two other companies, you know. So it disappeared pretty much without a whimper, and it deserved to. And so Bugliosi's book, which in my book, the JFK assassination, I devote a large part of that to Vincent Bugliosi's book. And the shocking thing about Bugliosi's book is that he says he spent 20 years on this thing. And if you look at his footnotes, which I had to do, okay, it's almost like he never left his office, you know, because you see like NARA, National Archives, request to Steve Tilley, phone call with such and such a person, phone call with such and such. In this day and age, to write a book on a JFK case and do it from your house, okay, is, you know, I just don't see how you can do that. I've been to New Orleans four times. You know, I've been to Dallas twice. I've been to Washington several times to visit the National Archives. You simply can't write a book from your house, okay?
Now, it's interesting since you mentioned Bugliosi. Am I getting this wrong, or didn't at one point he provide evidence to you and Lisa in regards to the RFK case for Probe? What happened there? Did he turn?
What's really funny about this is, and it's something that very few people know, is that Vincent Bugliosi did think there was a conspiracy in the Bobby Kennedy assassination, but he didn't think there was a conspiracy in the JFK assassination. In fact, he told me once that he got involved in the prosecutor's office with the RFK case very early. Okay. And I think he something like signed a search warrant to Sirhan's car. Okay. Then he came to believe that it was a conspiracy, and he actually appeared in court, okay, for Bill Turner and John Christian when they were sued, okay, involving what they wrote about that case, all right? And Bugliosi backed them up all the way. He was also involved in the L.A. County Supervisor's investigation into the RFK case. So it's really, really odd that on this other one case, the RFK case, he's pro-conspiracy. On the JFK case, he's so anti-conspiracy. And this is really the offense part of how insulting his use of invective, which is almost knew no bounds, in that he wanted to ridicule, he wanted to caricature. Okay, all the critics of the case. I later met a colleague of Vince's down in Dallas, and he called me aside. I sat down with him, and he said, "Jim, I'm a lawyer friend of Vince's. He told me from the beginning that that is what he was going to do, okay? That he was going to come out on the Warren Report side, and he was going to vent his spleen on caricaturing and ridiculing the Warren Commission critics. Now, how can you possibly write an honest book if from the beginning, okay, you're intent on doing those kinds of things?" And I'll say this, I get off easy in the book, all right? People like Doug Horne, okay, I mean, Vince actually tried to caricature Doug Horne to the point that, you know, it's possible to communicate with a disturbed person for brief periods of time. You know, it's, I mean, he tried to completely ridicule and insult Doug Horne because Doug Horne was saying something that, in my opinion, is true. That the pictures and x-rays we have of JFK's brain in the National Archives are not JFK's brain, okay? And I did a lot of work on that in my book, and I think I proved it. They can't be JFK's brain for a lot of different reasons, which is not the subject of this show. But I just wanted to use that as an example of the kind of thing. And this is the kind of guy that Hanks and Goetzman wanted to work with. In fact, Goetzman actually said, Gary Goetzman is Tom Hanks' producing partner at Playtone. Gary Goetzman said, you know, me and Tom are children of the 60s, but when we read Vince's book, the scales came from our eyes, and we saw the truth of what really happened in the JFK assassination. I would like to make a deal with Gary Goetzman right now. Okay. I'll bet $1,000, okay, that he did not read every page of Vincent Bugliosi's book, okay? All right, and if he can prove to me in any way that he did, okay, I'll come up with the money. But he has to pay me if he can't prove it, okay? I don't believe. Now, do you believe this? Do you believe these two high-flying producers in Hollywood spent 2 months reading Vincent Bugliosi's 2,646-page book?
I don't think most people have had the time to read Bugliosi's book. And I mean, Bugliosi has done good work in the. I like The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, that book was
decent. Yes, that's actually a decent book, yeah. And his book on the Paula Jones case was a good book. And his book about the Supreme Court decision with the Bush versus Gore about the Florida election, that's a good book. See, when Vince dealt with a relatively simple subject in, say, 300 pages, he could be a good writer. But the JFK case was just too complex for him. Okay.
I was going to say, too, what's interesting about JFK's treatment in film, regardless of what you think of the assassination. And I mean, I'm from a younger generation. I don't think I'm connected to the assassination in the same way as a lot of folks that remember the day and whatnot. But it's odd to me, ever since Oliver Stone's JFK came out, the only movies that come out about JFK are either, the anti-Oliver Stone JFK movie, or there are movies about the Kennedys that are based on all these right-wing character assassinations, like that TV miniseries, that boilerplate melodrama from 2011, The Kennedys. And I'm just like, why are they so obsessed with making the Kennedys look like the most evil family?
You know, I didn't actually watch that one. Okay. I watched
it's pretty awful.
Okay, good. Thanks for warning me. Okay. I watched the documentary that was on CNN about a year ago, okay, and I've watched some of the other ones since, and the stuff on cable TV that is made to somehow show that somehow Oliver Stone was wrong, and the Warren, and I can't say that you're wrong about anything, because that is really what the steady diet has been ever since Gerald Posner's book. Case Closed came out. All right. Ever
since you're
going to
hate me for this, but I actually had Gerald Posner on a while back talking about his pharma book.
he didn't talk about the JFK case, did he?
No. We didn't talk.
All right,
JFK.
Fine. I was going to hang up. Okay. All right. Ever since Case Closed came out, that is what has happened in the mainstream media. Every cable TV show you see is supposed to prove that somehow Oswald did what the Warren Commission said he did. Every documentary or dramatization is supposed to show that what's the point in feeling sorry for the Kennedys? They were a bunch of bootleggers and gangsters and horrible people. Anyway,
but JFK was a cold warrior. And like I said, regardless of what you think of the assassination, one of the best things I think you've done with Kennedys and King is you pretty much show that he was not this Republican cold warrior. You know, what was it? Rush Limbaugh said, if Kennedy was alive today, he would be a ditto head. And you pretty much conclusively show, no, he wouldn't.
He said that?
Yeah, he did say that at one point.
Oh, my God. No, not at all. And in fact, one of the things that we tried to do at KennedysandKing.com is to trace Kennedy's foreign policy ideas from when he was a congressman to when he got into office, okay? And very, very, very few books had ever done that, okay? So I did some work on it. Later on, a couple of scholars named Philip Muhlenbeck and Robert Recove, they did books on it, okay? And so today, you have a whole record now of how Kennedy became the guy who did the great speech on Algeria in 1957. And if you've never read that speech, you don't know how radical Kennedy was, okay? Because he essentially said, did we really not realize what happened 3 years ago in Vietnam, where we backed France in a colonial war and they failed? All right. Are we really going to do the same thing again and back France in another colonial war? Don't we know what's going to happen? All right. We should have two objectives. Number one, to free Africa. And number two, to save the French nation. Now, that's in the summer of 1957. Let me say that again. That's the summer of 1957. Okay? You know who was in the Senate at that time period? Oh, people like Strom Thurmond, people like Jesse Helms, okay, all these right-wing nuts, you know, who are supposed to be Democrats, but they're not really Democrats, okay? You know, and here's this guy, who just won his first term, at the end of his first term, and he's making a speech like this. That speech drew, and I'm pretty close on this, if I'm off, if I'm not off of very much, 160 editorial responses throughout the country, two-thirds of them being negative. All right? Kennedy was so discouraged that he called his father and he said, "Dad, I think I made a mistake." All right? And Joe Kennedy says, "Oh, no, you didn't. Okay? You don't know how lucky you are. This thing is going to get worse and worse, and you're going to turn out to be a hero." By the end of the year, Kennedy was on the cover of Time magazine in a story called "Man Out Front." Okay? Because what happened is, and I don't know if it was designed to do this, but he became the guy the Republicans loved to hate, you know, because we had called them out on this Algerian war. So Eisenhower attacked him. John Foster Dulles attacked him. Richard Nixon attacked him, you know. And so he became the front runner for the 1960 election. All right. And then when he got into office, of course, these policies continued. All right. Algeria became a free country in 1962. Kennedy was going to withdraw from Vietnam. Kennedy backed Sukarno in Indonesia. All right. All right. In the Dominican Republic, he backed Juan Bosch, you know. So, you know, and Kennedy was the first guy, and I think the only guy, at least since, to tell Israel, "You're going to endanger your funding if you complete that Dimona reactor." Okay. And he also wanted to have a choice by the Palestinians, a refugee program, that the Palestinians could go whenever they wanted to go. In other words, they could return to Israel if they wanted, they could stay where they wanted, or they could move somewhere else, and the UN would pay for it. Okay? He backed that in May of 1963. All right. So, you know, that's John Kennedy. And by the way, his father was never mixed up with those Chicago gangsters. I did a whole report on this. That's a bunch of baloney. Joe Kennedy was making so much money in the stock business, in the real estate business, in the movie business. The idea that he would take a cut in pay and then endanger his security with the lives of his children is so ridiculous. I don't even want to talk about it. Okay.
So bringing this around and closing out, I wanted to mention real quick, you're working on this documentary series with Oliver Stone. Oliver Stone's been in the news again. Everyone's mad at him for this Bill Maher appearance he did, especially liberals, because he came out and said, you know, something about, "I don't think Russian interference was the reason the election was lost by the Democrats in 2016. And people were really angry that he said that, "Oh, look at kooky Oliver Stone. Look at kooky Oliver Stone." And I'm really tired. No, I'm not joking. I'm tired of hearing it. I'm also tired of hearing every time you bring up Oliver Stone now, people will say, "Oh, well, his films aren't ambiguous. They hit you over the head with their point." And I'm like, well, that's because he's one of the only populist filmmakers around today. He's not interested in making movies that obfuscate and don't communicate things clearly. He wants to communicate to the public, to we the people. And I actually respect that about him. But for some reason, he's so out of fashion with, you know, the sort of people that want to be seen as, you know, "Oh, we're the cultured set."
Look, the idea that he expressed, it's not something that's an outlier, okay? There's a lot of people who've done a lot of work on the whole Russian collusion idea, okay? People like Aaron Matei at the Nation, okay? People like Gareth Porter at Consortium News. People like Bill Binney, okay? He used to be in the NSA, all right? And the idea that somehow the Russians went ahead and broke into the DNC computers is something that is not proven. It's not proven. And in fact, in transcripts that were just declassified, okay, the guy who was supposed to do the work on that for CrowdStrike, he admitted, we can't prove it was infiltrated or exfiltrated, okay, one way or the other, all right? So that idea, and Gareth Porter, the whole thing about this Facebook stuff, you know, he did a study of it and said, at the most, this reached 60,000 people. And on top of that, these ads were not what they're represented as being, you know, anti-Clinton ads. All right. So Gareth Porter did a study of that. It's I think Oliver's correct on this. All right. You know, as far as his movies go, Untold History of the United States is a real achievement. Okay, and if you haven't seen it, you should. It's a very good documentary about the history of the United States in the 20th century. In fact, I'm still surprised he got it on, okay, because of so many of the things that he said in that movie that are just not popular things to say these days that fly in the face of what academia is supposed to stand for. That's a very good documentary. And his other documentary, South of the Border, okay, about how certain countries, of course, what happened in Uruguay, you know, the guy was forced to sit down, you know, to evacuate, abdicate by the military. He was utterly right about that, how those Latin American, the stuff that's happening in Brazil, okay? You know, Latin America, there were countries there that did not want to follow the gringo strategy. They didn't want to be part of this, all right? And Oliver met with about five of them. I mean, look what we're doing to Venezuela now. Okay, we're essentially going back to what John Foster Dulles did, okay, you know, back in the 50s.
Mr. CIA himself, the Dulles brothers.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah. And so I think Oliver's films, you know, he's become a very good documentary filmmaker, you know? I thought Snowden was a good movie.
I was thinking of some of his earlier films, even. Like, I see people now that will say, oh, well, Wall Street is just too in your face with its message. And I think to myself, well, maybe we need a film that says, oh, Wall Street is, like, pretty horrible. Why is that so wrong? Like, let's make a film that says Wall Street sucks. Let's help Main Street. I don't know.
Well, what about Salvador?
Exactly, yeah.
You know? Salvador was a very courageous film for him to make, okay, considering the time frame. Wasn't that 1985? I think when Reagan was still in office, I think, okay? You know, so to make a movie like that at that time period, I mean, which essentially said that the United States is backing a bunch of ugly, you know, criminals, okay, in their pursuit of power in Central America – Who else was making that kind of film back then? Oh, wait a minute. There was that other movie, Undercover, with Nick Nolte.
Yeah.
But I thought Salvador was much more uncompromised, you know, than that film was.
Well, when people say that Stone is too unambiguous, what they're really saying, they're claiming that he's politically biased. You know, oh, he's making these crazy lefty films, and they'll say, oh, the ambiguous film, that's a movie like Zero Dark Thirty. And I look at Zero Dark Thirty, I wanted to walk out of the theater, because I thought to myself, that's a propaganda film. It's not ambiguous, it's a pure propaganda film. But because Oliver Stone does a movie that shows the other perspective, it's considered, oh, this is unambiguous and it's lefty propaganda. It's BS. It's not biased at all. He's providing a different perspective.
Right, right. I totally agree. I mean, Zero Dark Thirty was, they were in cahoots with the CIA on that, both the director and the writer. Okay, and they went ahead and did, you know, as essentially a CIA approved film. You know, I mean, what is it about? It's about the hunt for Osama bin Laden. Okay, and here's my question, which was never brought out in the film. And I asked a couple guys in the CIA about this. What was the point in assassinating a 74-year-old guy when you knew where he lived, where you could have had him arrested, you could have brought him back to the United States and taken all the computer files out of where he lived, all the documents, all the papers, and you could have had him under detention, questioning him about everything and placing him on trial. What was I you know, and you know what the one McGovern told me when I asked him that, Ray McGovern? He said, Jim, I didn't agree with it either. Okay, but I think some people in the CIA thought, well, wait a second. What if he can prove that he wasn't involved in 9/11?
Well, you know what? It also reminded me, another film that I've only seen a few people call it out for what it was, but Clint Eastwood's American Sniper. I never see people say, oh, Clint Eastwood made a propaganda film with American Sniper. There were people like Michael Moore that said it. But for the most part, it was like, oh, this is Oscar bait material. But Oliver Stone gets attacked as being, oh, too liberal. I mean, that's where we're at. Hollywood.
Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree with you. It's really sad what's happened in about the last 10, 12 years. You know, very, very, very difficult to make any politically honest pictures anymore. And that's because the people you expect to make them, who we mentioned tonight, aren't interested. You know?
I love that in the book you mention Orson Welles. And, you know, yeah. Whenever I went to film school, everyone talked about Orson Welles. They never talked about the fact that he was, like, an ardent anti-fascist, very pro-labor movement. They never tell you that. Orson Welles was, like, a progressive hero. Yes. And they never tell you that. And they don't make filmmakers like that anymore.
Well, the way I quoted him, he said words of the effect, you know, 10 years ago, if you'd have told me the actors going to take over Hollywood, I'd say, that's a great idea. But now that I've seen what they're doing, maybe it wasn't such a great idea.
Wow. So, in closing, anything else you want to say, plug? I don't want to end on a negative note. You think there's any hope for Hollywood to become a little bit more progressive, maybe a little bit more liberal again?
Well, let's put it this way. I think if and when this film gets shown, this documentary I'm working on, because we have about 29 experts, okay, and because there's going to be an annotated screenplay before it gets shown. Oliver made a mistake on JFK. He didn't release the annotated screenplay until after it was shown. But in this case, it's going to be ready. In fact, I'm working on it right now. Okay, till about 3 o'clock in the morning. All right, this time it's going to be ready before it gets shown. Okay, and we're going to be able to prove everything that we're saying in this documentary. And we have people like Henry Lee, the great criminologist. Okay, we have people like James Galbraith, the son of John Kenneth Galbraith from the University of Texas. Okay, we've got people like John Thunheim, the chairman of the review board. All right, so that's the kind of people we have. All right, so I think that this is going to be very educational if and when it gets shown.
And how can people keep up with your work?
KennedysandKing.com. All right, and we have new articles every week.
Well, thank you again, James DiEugenio, for coming on Parallax Views.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the stage.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jim DiEugenio of the Kennedys and King website, author of The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today, and the writer behind the upcoming Oliver Stone documentary series, Destiny Betrayed, based on Jim's book of the same name. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views. by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Martin, Mark, Emilia, Brace, John, Gratz, Zach, and Ted. If you'd like to join those faithful listeners in getting your own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider supporting me on patreon.com/parallaxviews at the $10 or $15 tiers, and you too can get a shout out at the end of every Parallax Views episode, and you'll get the satisfaction of knowing that you're keeping this project alive. I do about 4 shows a week, plus the Patreon bonus show the week that was at the $5 tier with my co-host Casey, where we cover current events in a very loose fit style format. So again, consider throwing me some cash by donating on a monthly basis at patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.